War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Welcome to a special bonus episode of Key Battles of American History. This is your host, James Early, as always, and I am thrilled to present this special episode. I have a very special guest, a man that I respect a lot and a man whose work is just incredible, and I'm so honored that he's agreed to be with us. Our guest today is Jared Frederick. Jared is an instructor of history at Penn State University at Altoona, who specializes in American history and public history. Receiving his MA from West Virginia University in 2012, Jared has also served as a park ranger at Gettysburg National Military Park, my dream job, and publisher of historical books for young adults. Highly involved with regional museums, cultural attractions, and institutions, he is a strong proponent of grassroots history. With this conviction in mind, he helped establish Penn State Altoona's Public History Initiative in 2013 to build a collaborative spirit among local historical sites and to offer students career-building opportunities at such venues. Beyond central Pennsylvania, he has completed projects in conjunction with the Smithsonian Institution, NASA, and the Pennsylvania Civil War 150. Additionally, he has served as a commentator on a number of films and documentaries. His areas of expertise include American history, U.S. military history, public history, Pennsylvania history, and film. His most recent book is Images of Modern America, Gettysburg National Military Park, published in 2016. Above all else, he strives to bring the past to life through meaningful educational experiences, both in and out of the classroom. Jared also has written several other books, which I'm sure we'll talk about over the course of the interview. And one thing that this bio does not mention is that he fairly recently started a YouTube page called Real History, R-E-E-L. And I found this recently, and I just started binge watching all the videos. I absolutely fell in love with it. Great channel. Longtime listeners of this podcast know that I, of course, love U.S. history, especially military history, and I love movies. So this YouTube page is a natural fit for me. So, Jared, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing today?
Thank you for having me. And your introduction, which was very cordial and welcomed, remind me of how much I need to update my biography on the university website. So thank you to start off with.
Yeah, okay. It's all lies, people. It's all, no, just kidding. But anyway, I'm so excited to have you here, Jared. We are recording this via Skype. So if there are any issues with the audio quality, I apologize, listener, but I think it's not really going to matter because Jared has such a fascinating story, and it's just going to be, you're going to love it. So here we go. So Jared, man, I got to tell you, regarding your YouTube channel, I started with the Gettysburg series, and Gettysburg is one of my all-time favorite movies. I love it so much. I've watched the movie many times. I've read the book, The Killer Angels, many times, and I even did my own series with a couple other guys in which we analyzed the film, and I've listened to a lot of commentary about the movie, and I've, as I said, I've done my own, but yours is the best I've ever heard. I put that as a comment on your page. So
thank you.
Thank you for doing
future.
But let's go back to the beginning. When and how did you first develop a passion for history?
Well, ironically enough, it started with the movie Gettysburg, because I saw that movie when I was in grade school, and that's where a sense of scale and scope about the past was really instilled in me. Now, I had visited a number of historical sites earlier in my youth. I'd visited Jamestown and Colonial Williamsburg. I had family who lived in that area, and that was part of many family travels when I was very young. But the fact that I live in central Pennsylvania and Gettysburg was not too terribly far away, It became the beginning of many family vacations when I was in grade school and middle school. And so, as is the case with so many of us who study history, it was a good film or a book or a family vacation that really sparked this lifelong passion in me.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Gettysburg is, it's just such a wonderful movie, especially for us history nerds and Civil War fanatics. I teach, my listeners know that I teach at San Jacinto College part-time. I teach U.S. history in the evenings and sometimes online. It's San Jacinto is colleges in the Houston area. And I let my students watch movies and write a report on each movie for extra credit. And Gettysburg is always on the list for the first semester. And I tell them it's worth two, like it counts as two because it's twice as long. It's over 4 hours long. And they just look at me like I'm nuts. And I've only ever had like two students do it in 7 years of teaching. But then I tell them I went to see it in the theater when it first came out. Twice. Uh-huh. They just look at me like, what? You are insane. But and then I tell them,
I'm interested, though, what were their reactions to the film, those few who did watch it?
Oh, it's funny you should ask. I only had two watch it, and they turned in the report, and I said, so what did you think of it? And they just looked at me and said, it was long.
Yeah. That was it. So,
you know, most of my students are not big history fanatics. The U.S. history is required in Texas colleges, just like, I guess, in any state. But, I haven't ever had one so far tell me that, oh, it was just fantastic.
Interesting. And, you know, it kind of further reinforces in my own mind what perhaps a strange child I was, that I could sit and watch it all in one sitting and be very captivated by it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I was 25 when it came out, so, but you were just
a kid. Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, 7 or 8 the first time I saw it, and, you know, all of my friends were watching Power Rangers, but, you know, I was watching movies like that, so perhaps it was a foregone conclusion that I would be doing this as my profession later.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, let's move on. So when did you first decide to become a history professor? And did you follow a direct path towards your career, or have you had other careers? I'm guessing you probably haven't had a lot of time to have other careers. You're still a really young man. But what would you say?
I suppose that's true to an extent. And I guess the best way that I can answer it is that by the time I was in fifth grade, I knew I wanted to do something in history. Where exactly that path would take me was not immediately evident. But by the time I got into high school, I started volunteering with the National Park Service, and I immediately grew smitten with that line of work and public history, and it opened up all sorts of doors for me, both professionally and personally. And so as I entered college, my real aspiration was to become a park ranger. And I was for a few years, and I worked seasonally at Gettysburg, as you said in your introduction. And I also worked for a short time at Harper's Ferry National Historical Park. And so I was kind of living these dual lives in both public history and academic history. And for about 2 years, I would work for the National Park Service during the summertime. And then during the fall and the spring, I would work at Penn State Altoona. And so it was a very interesting and sometimes adventurous chapter in my life where I had three different addresses. And it was a very lively time, and I don't regret doing any of it. But at that moment, getting a full-time job in the National Park Service is something that was very competitive and difficult. And for a lot of young professionals, it sometimes seemed like the system was rigged against us. And so ultimately, I went back into academia, and in 2014, I was offered a full-time job at Penn State Altoona, and I've been doing that ever since. All that said, I still very much keep in touch with my friends in the National Park Service and have the opportunity to assist them in various projects on an as-need basis.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I always kind of envy people that, like yourself, who are history buffs, who grew up in places like Pennsylvania or Virginia or Massachusetts or New York, places on the East, because there's so much Civil War and Revolutionary history there. There's so many sites. You know, I grew up in Houston, Texas, and there's just not a lot out here. There's a little bit of Texas history stuff, but even that is kind of few and far between and spread out. And so, like, I mean, I even if I'd wanted to volunteer at Gettysburg or something, there was no possible way. So that's really neat. That's great that you got to do that. And it's funny because every now and then I watch a video of the American Battlefield Trust. Just the other day I was watching one, and lo and behold, there's you. There's Jared Frederick. Hey, a very young Jared Frederick.
Yes. I've noticed myself aging in these videos as we move along. Yeah.
Oh, the stress, you know. Oh, the burden. But yeah, this was pre-beard Jared Frederick.
Yes.
But anyway, well, let's talk about what you're doing at the college. You implied that the bio is a little bit out of date. So what kind of courses do you teach now, and what other courses have you taught? And maybe tell me, like, what are your favorite courses to teach?
I've taught about a dozen different courses, and for the most part, they're all focused in various realms of American history. Some of my most consistent courses are classes that are your kind of generic American history survey classes. Mm. But one that I teach every semester and fills up without fail is Pennsylvania history. And that undoubtedly is because most of our students are from Pennsylvania, and I suspect that it's something that they feel that they can relate to, or that they perhaps have an interest in learning more about. And so that's one of our more popular classes, and I've yet to have a section of it that hasn't filled up rather quickly. But then I get into some specialty classes as well. I teach a number of classes on the Civil War. There's one that looks at the Civil War era in a rather comprehensive manner. There is one on the Battle of Gettysburg and history and memory, which is in some ways broken down into three sections. There's a section on the battle and the war itself. There's a section on early preservation and commemoration and the meaning and the legacy of the Gettysburg Address. And then there's a final element of it that looks at additional preservation, Gettysburg's place in popular culture and American memory. And that one's a lot of fun because it's a super niche topic where we can really delve into this idea of micro history. Like, how does one particular place in the American mindset, what does it tell us about our country and about ourselves and about how we connect with public lands and history? And it just opens up the door to all these sorts of wonderful conversations. And then an additional Civil War class, the one that I've started to teach fairly recently, is Slavery and the Civil War in Cinema. And that ties in very well with my fairly recent YouTube channel with Real History. I spent a lot of time on the Civil War, but I've also taught classes on public history, 1960s America. Let's see, what are some other ones? The World War II in the Pacific and Asia. I get around, and I really enjoy teaching new classes when the opportunity arises, because it keeps me on my toes and prevents me from falling into a routine.
Oh, that is really great. I bet Pennsylvania history is really fascinating. I don't know that much about it myself, but
it really is. And it covers a very broad swath of time, you know, going back thousands of years. You know, we start with herbivore dinosaurs and, you know, archaeology and end up going, you know, into the 21st century. There's something in it for everyone. There's geography, there's science, there's history, there's politics, there's art, there's sports. There's a little bit of everything in it, and I think that's why it's such an enjoyable class.
Oh, that's great. And that slavery in cinema, man, I want to sign up for that. Like, do you let people audit? Do you have online sections? Can somebody in Texas take one?
A year ago, my answer would have been yes, because pretty much all of our classes were online due to the pandemic. But in the spring, it will be in person. And unfortunately, it wouldn't work quite as well. But if it ever is put online again, I will be sure to let you know.
Yeah, I'll just keep watching your YouTube videos, and that'll have to do me, I think.
That's a good second place option.
Yeah. Now, speaking about that, I'm curious, my experience, and I might be wrong on this, but I know in the podcasting world, most history podcasts are not done by professional academics. There are a few. There's Greg Jackson, who does History That Doesn't Suck. He's a history professor in Utah Valley University. There's probably some others that I'm not aware of, but when I listen to a history podcast, 90% of the time, it's just an average Joe who loves history. And that seems to be the case with YouTube channels as well. I don't see a lot of professional historians who actually do YouTube channels. There are some that appear on them. Certainly, there are lecture series that you can watch from Yale University and other places. But I don't see a lot of academics doing YouTube channels of their own. So what prompted you to start doing this YouTube channel, and how did you decide what specific topics your channel would cover?
There's a few different ways I could answer that, and I guess the first one is to kind of broadly address the issue of, you know, why don't more professors?
Yeah, please do. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
And you know, and it goes back to my days as a park ranger, because my whole philosophy as an educator is to reach as large an audience as is humanly possible. And unfortunately, some of the limitations of academia do not always allow that. And so what I try to do is that I try to balance my academic scholarship while also kind of keeping my foot at the ground level and kind of getting a sense of, you know, what are the trends and tastes and the fascinations within popular culture and collective American consciousness. And so what I really try to do is that, you know, I still write, I still research, but I never try to stray too far away from my days in public history. And frankly, you know, I think more history professors need to do things like that. I mean, I think more professors should do reenacting. I think more professors should volunteer at local museums. I think more professors should do podcasts and have YouTube channels. Because if they don't start to do it, they're going to render themselves obsolete in the eyes of public opinion. And there are ways where you can share really engaging and wonderful and informative research while also making it digestible and not obfuscating it with so much academic jargon that it's unreachable to the majority of people who might come across it. And so that's one aspect of it. And I suspect that I have a strong philosophical difference in comparison to many in academia in that regard. But as to the channel itself, it really started as a pandemic project with my friend Andrew Collins and I, simply because we were so doggone bored during the pandemic. he's a reenacting buddy of mine. And, you know, his wife and I were friends even before we met him. I met him. And, you know, I would often, you know, go over to their house and, you know, we would watch movies on his projector that would drop down from the ceiling. And you know, I would always give color commentary while we were watching historical films. And he said, you know what? We should just make this into a channel. Like, you can still do what you always do. We're just going to put a camera in front of you and formalize it a little bit. And so that was the genesis of Real History. And here we are exactly, I think, a year and a day later. We've done about 36 videos. We've gotten about 17,000 subscribers in that time. And we're going pretty strong, and we're going to keep doing what we're doing because it's a lot of fun. And the feedback and the interaction, it's allowed me to meet and converse with people like you and so many others. And I think it speaks to the changing nature of public history, because there's really, you know, on cable television, there just aren't many places where people can go to get good history. When I was growing up, the History Channel was the go-to place for that, but instead they focus on aliens and swamp people now. Right. So increasingly, YouTube is the place to go. And as you suggested, you know, some of the most successful pages out there and channels are, you know, run by amateur historians who just have a real passion for telling stories and doing their own research. And so I think really that is the future of historical broadcasting.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors. Yeah, I agree with you completely, because I know when nowadays when somebody contacts me and says, hey, I've got a young man or a student I know or somebody that wants to learn more about the Civil War, the first thing they say is, can you recommend some videos, right? YouTube videos or something. They don't say a book, because if you think about it, the average person is not necessarily going to read, let's say, James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom,
right?
Or much less Shelby Foote's 3-volume series or Battles and Leaders of the Civil War, something like that. But they'll sit down and watch a half-hour YouTube video. And so I agree with you that is the future for history education, at least for the masses, like for lay people.
Absolutely. I think especially so for college students as well, because, you know, increasingly we as humans, we are visual learners. And what I always try to do in the classroom, regardless of what topic I'm discussing, I always try to show, you know, perhaps 10 minutes of a film or a documentary. Not only does that give everybody a breather, myself included, but it allows students to gain other perspectives other than my own, and it offers them a very important visualization of the topics that we are discussing. And at the end of every semester, when students fill out their anonymous surveys at the end of a class, that's always something that gets really high marks, is that students really appreciate, you know, watching snippets of film and documentary. And it's not just because it's, you know, an easy way out of work or anything like that, but it really helps them comprehend the subject matter at hand. And I think that's something that educators at all grade levels should keep into consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. My students, when I get my reviews and ratings at the end of the semester, they always talk, or several of them talk about how much they love doing the extra credit movie assignment where I just have them watch a movie and I give them 5 questions to write. Each question is about a paragraph, and they have to, one of the things is they have to go to some sites and do a little research, and they have to tell me 3 things they got right and 3 things the movie got wrong. You know, what was historically accurate and what was not accurate. And it helps them to understand that not everything is true just because it's in a movie. You
know? Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of students don't grasp that reality immediately. And so I think there's room for all sorts of valuable conversations in the classroom and elsewhere along those lines.
Right. All right. So another question I have for you is, what have been the greatest difficulties and or challenges that you have faced in creating and producing your channel?
It's certainly been a learning curve because my producer, you know, he's not, you know, a communications expert or videographer by trade, but we both like to think that the quality of our videos has gotten better with each one, because some of our earlier ones are really clunky when you go back and look at them, but you know, that's how a channel grows. And it's really that the success is just about finding the right sort of ingredients and analyzing the right sort of films. And really our big breakthrough moment is when we started looking at the Band of Brothers series.
Oh yeah, that I love that. And I love that series, and I love your commentary on the series. Your series you, on that series.
Yeah, and you know, there's few other films like it because you know it's the series is 20 years old, but it still has this incredible shelf life to it. And you know, it's been on TV and it's still watched by, you know, active duty people in the military. A few weeks ago, I was down at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and you know, I gave some presentations to some paratroopers in the 82nd Airborne, and that was on my latest book, which is about Dick Winters, who's the main protagonist in Band of Brothers, and everybody had seen it. Despite the fact that most of them were toddlers when the series came out. I mean, there's few other television shows or miniseries that are like that. And yeah,
it's so fresh. I mean, I just watched through the series recently again, and it could have come out this year. You know, it doesn't look old.
No. And it just has, it captivated viewers all across the world, and it still continues to captivate people. And I think it serves as an important lesson for historians as well, that sometimes the past is best served in small doses that are personable and approachable. That's the great success of Band of Brothers. And that's one reason why it continues to do well still. But in any case, looking at that series on the eve of the 20th anniversary of the show, no less, was really where we started to gain an audience. And, you know, I suspect that we've perhaps had it a little bit easier than some other YouTubers or podcasters because the material that we have to work with is so easy to attract an audience with because everybody watches movies. We've started out with some really popular ones, Forrest Gump, Titanic, Gettysburg, Apollo 13, 1917. These are very popular movies. And even if people haven't read books on the subject, they've probably at least heard of those films before. And another factor that propelled us into doing this is you know, so often, you know, we were coming across these reaction videos where people were just kind of giving these visceral first impressions as they're watching movies, sometimes historical movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and people were just, you know, kind of making these ill-informed assumptions about these films that they were watching. You know, Saving Private Ryan was a really notable one in that regard. And so we decided to turn that formula upside down. And rather than me just watching a movie for the first time and kind of giving you this blank expression and reaction, right. We thought, you know, we can frame this almost like a director does commentary on a DVD. And by flipping back between my commentary and clips of the movie, I think it goes a long way in keeping people's attention. And so it's our hope that it's a unique way for people to learn the background of movies that they already love or are familiar with.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. I think you've hit upon a winning formula. That's something original and fresh that you don't really see. It's not just you just going, whoa, man.
Right.
But you give very... you know, history-based, very, informative commentary, like a director's commentary on a DVD or something. I think that's a good analogy. It's, let me ask you this. So I know, you probably don't get that many. This question is, I'm going off script here. So, but with comments, I remember, in one of your recent shows, somebody said something like, well, how do you call yourself a history professor if you don't know this one thing? And I love what you said. You said, if you're going to bring the snark, you got to do your homework. So
yeah,
how do you deal? I mean, I'm sure 90%
answer positive, but how do you deal with these ones that are snarky or just stupid sometimes?
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is that oftentimes people who make those comments do not anticipate us seeing them and actually writing back.
Yeah.
And this is you know, social media and the interwebs work in very strange ways sometimes. Sometimes when we call people out for their snark or their sarcasm or their just being ill-informed, oftentimes people will apologize in their comments and they're like, you know what, you're right. You know, we were too harsh on you for saying that. Right. I'm sorry. I'm going to subscribe now. And so like when you actually grab the bull by the horns, sometimes people backpedal and they disengage. But you know, it is the internet. There's a lot of keyboard courage out there and we certainly don't let it get to us. Because after all, every comment helps the algorithms and allows more people to see us. So we're happy to take on comments of any form.
Yeah, you know, I read a quote from Donald Rumsfeld of all people one time, and he said, "If you're not getting any criticism, then you're probably not even doing anything." So the point is, if you're gonna put yourself out there, and if you're gonna try to make a contribution in the form of a podcast or YouTube channel, you're always going to get somebody that criticizes you. And I get some negative comments and I find that 90% of them are just really not valid. You know, they just like criticize, they'll say, well, you didn't go into enough detail on this battle. Reply to Apple Podcast comments, but I want to just reply and say, well, duh, I told you from the beginning, this is an intro to the topic. I'm not going to go into great detail on anything, you know?
Right.
So, you know, you don't expect me to do something that I didn't even
first place, but anyway,
to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, you'll never be able to please all the people all the time.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Lincoln knew what he was talking about, too.
Indeed.
Oh, man. Okay, so here's another question. What are the greatest rewards that you derive from your channel? Like, tell me some of the highs you get from it or the blessings.
I suppose there's two ways I can answer that. One aspect that I really appreciate and take to heart is when people write in the comments and they say that I wish I had had a history professor, a history teacher like you while I was growing up, because my whole outlook on the study of the past or life would be really different. And those sorts of comments pop up often. And that's something that really humbles me and makes me think that my work is worthwhile. The other aspect that I think is really rewarding is when people kind of open themselves up in the comments section, where they talk about some of their own personal experiences or that of family members. In our episode on Forrest Gump, a lot of Vietnam War veterans who started talking about their experiences where they were able to relate to, you know, Forrest's exploits in Vietnam or some of the things that he went through. And, you know, our commentary was a gateway for them to open up about that and share some of their stories, you know, on these social media venues. And then, you know, there are, you know, in looking at something like the Holocaust episode in Band of Brothers. Mm. A lot of people wrote comments, you know, attesting to the experiences of their family members or their grandparents or their great-grandparents who went through the Holocaust and, you know, expressing thanks to American GIs and liberators of other allied nations who participated in bringing an end to that dreadful episode of history. It's stuff like that where people express their personal outlooks and likewise their appreciation where something like real history, I think, is most rewarding.
That is wonderful. I didn't even know, because I don't really read deep into the comments. I watch the videos, of course, and I sometimes will put a comment, but I didn't know that you were having those kind of conversations as comments. That's really wonderful that people are able to. It must be kind of cathartic for some people, you know?
I think so. Most definitely.
Yeah. I know for me, the series The Pacific is especially meaningful and personal because I don't think I told you this, but my father was in the Marines and he fought in the Pacific Theater. He was much older than me. He was born in 1919. I was born in 1968, but he was in some of the nastiest battles. He was in Guadalcanal. He was at Tarawa. He was at Iwo Jima, and he was at Okinawa. Wow. And just hell after hell after hell after hell. And at Guadalcanal, he was in Carlson's Raiders, you know, and he was in the he was part of the long patrol that they were behind Japanese lines for a good month or so, and just in constant danger, constant stress. And but you know, I think you talk about this in some of your videos. The guys, they just didn't talk about it. That their generation's method of dealing with the stress and the PTSD that they had was just to kind of put it in a box and put it away, you know, put it on the shelf, don't talk about it. And so to this day, I know almost nothing about what my dad did I know literally nothing about what he was doing at Iwo Jima and Okinawa. I do know a little about what he did at Guadalcanal and Tarawa because I found some interviews with him later, but still. I guess all that is just to say that sometimes these videos are more than just history for people. I think that's just piggybacking on what you were talking about. You know, you Vietnam vets seeing something about Forrest Gump or some other Vietnam movie, World War II vets or sons or grandsons, granddaughters of World War II vets. It's like if you watch Band of Brothers or if you watch The Pacific, you get an idea of what your grandfather or great-grandfather or father went through, you know, and it really... Right. It can hit you in the gut, you know. James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Right, and I think that's the big takeaway of something like that, because, you know, less than 15% of American service members in the European Theater of Operations were paratroopers. I mean, they were very exclusive, comparatively small units of men in the big picture, but to your point exactly, their stories become representative of the generation, and they become a vehicle for us understanding what was endured in the 1940s. And I think you'll be pleased to hear that as you and I are having this conversation right now, we are filming the episodes looking at the Pacific as we speak.
Oh, yes. That gives me an excuse. So, I've got to go rewatch them now. That gives me an excuse. It's homework.
Yes, indeed. And so before year's end, we will have a good number of the episodes of The Pacific being broadcast. You've heard it here for the first time.
Outstanding. I don't know when... I don't know when this is going to go out, Jared. I think I'm going to release this one pretty soon. I usually have a big kind of a bubble, like I record and then I release the episode 6 months later. But I don't think now I've got to get this out there so we can get you some more viewers for your Pacific series. Yeah, I'm excited. Wonderful. Yeah. All right. So, well, you kind of already then anticipated another question I was going to ask you, and that, like, what's coming up on Real History? So you said the Pacific. Can you tell me anything else?
Sure. Yeah. We will probably be having the Pacific will be airing throughout the month of December and into January. And
excellent.
What we also have lined up to kind of break up the darkness of that series is that we're going to be doing a holiday special or two of Christmas movies that are set during historical time periods. And your listeners might be able to guess what those movies will be, which ones we'll be analyzing. But I'll leave those ones a surprise for now, and people can head on over to the channel and see what's up.
Oh, that sounds great. All right. I think I'm going to probably try to shoot for mid-December to release this, so that'll be just about perfect.
Perfect.
Okay, do you have any other final thoughts you would like to share? Words of wisdom? I don't know. No pressure there.
You know, I would just say, you know, that you know, for anybody who's tuning in, if you have a passion for the past, don't keep it bottled up. You know, you don't have to write a bestseller. You don't have to start a YouTube channel or be a talking head in a documentary. Sometimes the most important work is done at the community level. And, you know, museums and historic sites, they've gone through a really hard time during the pandemic. And a few weeks ago, I read in the Washington Post that, you know, perhaps a quarter of the museums in the United States won't survive the ripple effects of the pandemic. And so if you appreciate history, I would encourage everybody to go out and make the most of your enthusiasm. Share the wealth. Help a museum that needs your expertise and your energy. Because ultimately, that's one of the best ways as to how history is shared. And so that's what the plea that I will put before our audience here on the show. You know, go out and make the most of your knowledge and your expertise.
Yeah, that's terrific. You know, recently I went to the National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg, Texas.
Oh, you have? Okay, yeah. And at the Nimitz House and Hotel.
Right.
And it was funny because I was there with a couple of friends and we were walking through and there was this one man that had a crowd around him and he was talking about, I think it was the PT boat that they have there. And he was telling them all this stuff. And I said, oh, are you a guide here? And he says, no, I'm just a visitor, but I just love history. And I thought, man, you need to work. I think I said to him, you need to work here or at least volunteer.
Right.
Here. That's really cool. That's kind of my dream job. I hit on that earlier is I wanted to, I'd love to be a volunteer park ranger after I retire from my day job and my other jobs. I got to get my kids through college first though. So we'll see. But,
sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, great words. And you know, I hope that you and I can collaborate in some form or fashion in the future. It seems to me, this is another thing that's not in the script, but I'd like to know your thoughts on this. It seems to me that there's a big gulf or a gap between the podcast world and the YouTube world. You know, I follow a ton of YouTube history channels, and oftentimes they collaborate, you know, like Mr. Beat will get involved with so-and-so, the cynical historian or somebody like that, and these guys will be on each other's shows, but they don't ever, like, collaborate with, I don't see a YouTuber collaborating with a podcaster. Likewise, podcasters will cross-pollinate, and they'll be on each other's shows. I've done that a lot with other podcasters, but there seems to be a great gulf fixed between the video world and the audio world, so do you agree with that, or what do you think?
Yeah, I suspect that is true, and I'm guilty of it myself. I don't listen to too many podcasts, nor do I really have much time to watch other YouTube channels. And, you know, I think it really comes down to the fact that for the YouTubers and podcasters who are most active out there, they're just so consumed and wrapped up in their own schedules of producing their own content that they often don't have the time to have that kind of leisurely time to enjoy other people's content and activity. So
yeah,
I don't suspect that it's necessarily a cultural thing. I suspect it's more of a logistical thing.
Yeah, probably so. But hey, you've taken the first step, right? You've appeared on a podcast.
I'm glad to have been here and glad to do it. And I hope we can do it again.
Yeah, let's do it. Now, before you go, and by the way, after we stop recording, can you stay on for a little? Because I had a couple other things I want to talk to you about. But before we end the podcast episode, tell us about your books. I'd like to give our listeners an opportunity to purchase one or more of your books. I know they would love that. I wish I was at Gettysburg this summer. I went up there in July. I wish I had had your book in my hands, but I didn't even know about it at the time. So, but tell us what are the names of your books?
In addition to my Gettysburg book, which is simply entitled Gettysburg National Military Park, that is a photographic history on the park's evolution, and mostly since the 1950s. And so it's a fairly modern perspective on that iconic battleground. And that was followed up in 2019 by my book about the Normandy invasion, which was called Dispatches of D-Day. And what I did with that book is that I spent over a year combing through different newspaper accounts, thousands of newspaper accounts, chronicling the Normandy invasion. And I gathered what I thought were the best and most revealing of them and stitched them together in narrative format. And so it's a very organic history of the Normandy invasion, told almost exclusively through the eyes of people who were at the ground level, both on the battlefront and the home front. That was followed up in 2020 by a book on Major Dick Winters that I co-authored with my friend Eric Dorr. And that book is entitled Hang Tough. And that looks at Dick Winters' wartime correspondence to a female pen pal who was in the United States Navy at the same time he was overseas. And that book is also filled with a lot of rich, colorful photographs of his various artifacts that are in my co-author's museum, which is also located in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And then as a follow-up of sorts, we are delving into what's sometimes deemed the mysterious life of Ronald Spears, who became commander of Easy Company after Dick Winters was promoted. And there are many sometimes sordid stories about his reputation and his exploits. And in our book, we'll be seeking to clarify some of those stories while also painting a broader picture of his life. That book will be entitled Fierce Valor, and it will be released in May of 2022.
All right. Well, that's great. So those sound like really good Christmas presents to me for history buff that you may know, listener, or maybe for yourself. Buy yourself a present. Why not? Where can you get those, Jared? Amazon? Any other places?
Yeah, you can get those all on Amazon. At the time that we're having this conversation, the Hang Tough book actually sold out. I think it superseded the expectations of even the publisher. Hopefully sometime in the very, very near future, a second edition will be out. But it is on Amazon and probably on the secondary market at the moment, too.
All right. Very good. Well, I'll definitely have to get this out well before Christmas now. I'll put it out as soon as I can. We're recording just before Thanksgiving, but I'm going to try to get this out no later than mid-December so that maybe some people will buy the books for their history nut loved ones or for themselves, and that'll help you out a little bit there, Jared.
That'd
be
you.
Great. I got to get them too and read them, but right now I'm researching a new series for my podcast.
It's hard to find the time to do anything other than the project you're working on currently.
Right.
All right. Well, this has been a great conversation, Jared. I appreciate so much you coming on the show and sharing your background and your work with us. And listeners, definitely, again, check out Jared's books as well as check out the YouTube channel Real History. And I'm especially excited about the Pacific series since I'm in the process of wrapping up my own.
The Pacific War. I did a 30-part series with a partner, Scott Rank, and we still just barely scratched the surface, you know. But you could do years and years and years on that. But
absolutely.
I don't have the attention span. I don't have the patience. You know, I'm ready to move on to something else after that. But all right, thanks again, Jared, and hopefully we'll be in touch again.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are 5 different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Brandon Cuckler, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, and Jacob Thomason, Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabrese, Alex Coombs, Jacob Dyke, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Mike Leslie, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Doug Pergram, Michael Rollison, David Santee, Michael Severino, Josh Wheatley, and Gregory Works, and Lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burke, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Roger Douglas, Michael Fain, Scott Hendricks, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.